Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, and it is always a pleasure to talk to her, is poet and photographer Alexis Roan Fancher, and we're talking about her new book, Triggered, a pillow book. Alexis, it's such a pleasure to talk to you again.
Thanks, Mark. Likewise. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
If there was ever a book of poetry called Triggered, I think you would have to be the person to write it. Now, this is a pillow book. Talk to me about what a pillow book means to you.
Well, it originates in Japan, and it's a kind of a sex book or a book about sexuality. Originally, it could even be a how-to book.
Yeah. But this isn't, although there is a tremendous amount of graphic sex in this book, it's never just about the sex.
No, it's about power.
Yeah, and I have to say that reading your books over the years, it's really made me like reflect and think about, you know, what physical relationships mean, and not just to me, but to other people I know, and it's really intriguing. Now, I want to mention that the illustrations are done by Kenna Baradell. Is that
yes.
Her? Talk to me about who she is.
She's an artist, a brilliant artist who lives in Vancouver, Canada. We met online many years ago, and her art is a lot like my erotic work, and we found a sort of niche. Then she sent me the drawing, which is huge, by the way. I mean, it's feet by feet, gigantic.
The cover art? Are you talking about the cover?
Yeah.
Wow.
And if you go to the very last page of the book, inside the back cover, you'll see the whole of the the entire, all the poets are naked. It just kind of flowed out of that. As you see, her paintings are spectacular. I was thrilled to work with her.
Where is she from?
Canada, Vancouver, British Columbia.
Jesus, wow, okay. Now, let's talk about, I have to mention for the benefit of the audience that most of these poems, I can't have you read over the air, just because they're very viscerally erotic and sexual, like How to Eat an Artichoke and Cream Puff. I loved How to Eat an Artichoke. That was amazing. That was pretty incredible.
I was dared by a friend, not a poet, but a friend of mine. He said, why don't you write more about food? I said, okay, I'm going to write one, and you can write one. I think I'll do artichokes. You have to admit, it's a pretty erotic fruit or vegetable, I guess.
I never considered it until your poetry. I always thought it was just this weird, complicated thing that I had to get through. Now I'll take my time next time I'm meeting the next artichoke. It reminded me, there's a scene in the movie Women in Love where one of the main characters demonstrates how to eat a fig.
And Was it Glenda Jackson?
It was a male. And that was amazing. That was very similar to this. I wish it was Glenda Jackson.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Let's start out with a poem. Listening to Bill Evans play Stella by Starlight. I love that, the idea of that.
Okay. This is, I'm not quite sure what they call it. It almost is the ABC Darien. I wrote Stella by Starlight down the page and then wrote lines so they would all come together. Excuse me. Listening to Bill Evans play Stella by Starlight. I listen to Stella by Starlight and shiver deep, in a nameless place. And that's what kind of gave birth to the poem. It's by the little epigraph is by Gary Lemons, another really remarkable poet, Northern California, I believe, or Washington. Anyway, give me a second here. Listening to Bill Evans play Stella by Starlight. Sidetracked, hijacked, the words unnecessary, but each syncopated lyric, each luscious lament added up. Brazen, words seemed muddying perfection, yet suppose those lyrics meant something. something to somebody, a melody reinterpreted, lit up. It started out like we did, wordless, gained momentum, hurtled into starlight, the words, the music, the two of us.
In the introduction to this book, Jude Dillon called Kenna's art existential erotica, and that relates. Do you feel that's a good criticism or a good phrase to use describing your poems?
I like that. Yeah, I read that recently when I was reading over the book, and I think why not?
Que sera, sera.
I'm not around to make people think the way I do. I just want to get people out of whatever rut they're in and run around in my stuff for a while, you know?
Well, do you see that as part of the problem? Do you find today's contemporary society a lot straighter or a lot more regimented than, say, 30 years ago?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so, too, and it's weird. I mean, I lived through the 60s, the end of the 60s especially. And it's always odd for me to look back on those times, and that even gets to the title of this book, Triggered. The idea of that just didn't seem to come up until the last 10, 15 years.
Well, it started, I don't know, for me, Triggered has a lot of baggage attached to it. It's like suddenly you have to let people know everything about what they're going to read, so their poor little, And it infantilizes women, you know, it really does, and not in a good way. So I finally just had enough, and one of my students said, do I need to put this trigger warning in the beginning of the book? And I said, if you do, I'll never work with you again.
So there would be a triggered warning about the book Triggered?
I don't think so.
I mean, that just sort of seems crazy, that you would have a book called Triggered, and then there would be a trigger warning in the beginning of the book. Sort of seems somehow Alice in Wonderland like that there would be that kind of warning about it. But it, you're right. I mean, I'm glad I'm not teaching at the university level right now, because everything you do has got to be passed through so many filters. It's just incredible. You never get anything done.
Well, when I started out on my writing career, I made a choice that I would not be in academia. I would not be anywhere where anybody had a hold over me monetarily or in any other way for the content of what I write. And that meant that I made my own money. I didn't depend on stipends or grants or anything like that. And, I mean, look at the word triggered. That's violent.
Yeah.
It's a violent word.
Right. It has to do with a gun.
Thank you. I just got fed up, and I looked at my husband, and I said, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to call it Triggered, and I'm going to put everything in there that could ever trigger anybody. The Nazis are in there. Erotica is in there. You name it. I just stuffed it full, and I really felt better afterwards, I have to say.
So it's very cathartic. This is a cathartic book. Well, I don't know. You have odes to Angelica's all her body parts. There's a poem about Angelica's breasts, her toes, her pillow lips. I mean, the list goes on. Is Angelica an actual person? I hate to ask you that because that's such a low grade question. But man, I really wanted to know who Angelica was.
She is a real person. I'm not in touch with her anymore. I don't know if she's still on this earthly plane, but she was my first female lover and the first woman that I just was fascinated by, and not as a friend but as a lover. I keep writing to her. I hope somewhere she's out there reading it.
You know, I know. Wouldn't it be amazing if you were to hear from her? I think that's just incredible.
Hey, that would be a nice day.
You mentioned when you were reading the last poem that it was an ABC ABC Darien poem.
Darien.
Yeah, can you explain that? Because I know that this is something that you do that a lot of other poets that I know don't do. You'll pick odd structures for poems and then write those. And I find myself having to go to the dictionary every time I get one of your collections of poetry just to understand the forms that you use. So what is that? What is an abecedarian poem?
Abecedarian. And I'm blanking on the poet, a famous poet that created this. And you just, a true abecedarian is A, B, C, D, and each line has a word that begins with that, you know.
Wow.
For this particular poem, I used the letters of Stella by Starlight running down the page, and then I had to fit my work into that structure. I really like sonnets. I like pantoons. I like
Whoa. Slow up there, babe. Pontoons? Right. Did you say pontoon?
A pantoum.
Pantoum, yeah.
Pantoum.
Yeah.
Yeah, where you repeat certain words or certain phrases and they sort of morph.
Do you like setting those challenges for you, for yourself?
I do. I think of it as a kind of scaffolding.
Okay.
You know, that's going to, you know, like you put on, you know, like you, when a woman gets dressed, she puts on pants, she puts on a bra, things move, things are different because there's a form. And for me, I really like challenging myself and creating something that's more difficult, that makes me a little uncomfortable.
Huh.
You know?
That makes total sense. Did you ever start, so you start out with the form first, then you write the poem, obviously. But did you ever pick a form that you were not able to write a poem using that form?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, the poem will dictate the form as much as the form will dictate the, I keep coming back to the word scaffolding, but the that the poem will be on the page.
But
I'm very conscious of that.
But it seems like you can't write the poem first, can you? Or can you write a poem and then change it up so that it fits the structure?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no wrong about that. Sometimes the structure informs what you're writing. I mean, and I will take it, like for a pantoum, I'll take a really strong line and start with that and just keep writing and then move the lines around. I don't think that's cheating. I think that's being really creative.
Now, there's so many of these poems. Again, we can't read on the air because people will faint. They'll swoon. They'll get the vapors. But I think they're pretty amazing. There's a poem, Phoebe's Vagina, and that was inspired by actual graffiti on a bathroom stall that you include the photograph of the graffiti.
Yes, I was in.
So you probably never met the Phoebe, right? Or did you know the Phoebe beforehand?
I did not know the Phoebe. I was with my cousin who lives in Chicago, my crazy cousin Leslie, and he took me to the Green Mill, which is a bar where Patricia Barber holds court quite often. And at one point, I excused myself. I said, "I'm going to go and use the bathroom." And he said, "Do me a favor, will you? Take a picture. I've always wondered what it looks like on the inside." And I had brought my cell phone camera, my trusty little iPhone, and I picked a stall at random, shut the door, and that's what it said. It said, "Phoebe has the most pleasurable vagina this side of Saturn, except for your mom." And I took three or four of the pictures, made sure the lighting was good. Went back and I showed my cousin. He about died. Lecherous old guy.
It's hilarious. I love bathroom graffiti like that. That's just amazing. Now,
yeah, but who's Phoebe, you know? Yeah,
I know. Can you imagine? I know. Where's Phoebe now? Now, this brings up another important thing in that I can no longer simply think of you as a poet, but as also as a photographer. Now, your photography has been going on as long as you've been doing poetry.
Oh, yeah. And as a young girl, my mom and my dad, my sister and I think I was 10, we went to San Francisco on a vacation, and my dad gave me a, you know, a brownie camera, one of the old school cameras, and a bunch of film. And I just shot everything I saw. And when the pictures came back, they were really something. I had an eye, and my father went out and bought me a Nikon.
Wow.
He said, you're a photographer. He was really into the arts. And yeah, so I've been shooting a long time. In fact, I've been shooting portraits of the poets.
Well, this brings up my next question, because we've been talking about this for almost as long as we've been talking. Because your photographs of the poets are not just simply portraits. They're really fascinating, and they have a lot of insight to the personality of the person who's being photographed. And they're mostly black and white. I've always loved them, and I've always talked about, why isn't there a book of your photographs of the poets? And there is now going to be a book.
Yes, there is. Eric Murago, who is the publisher extraordinaire of Moontide Press, really coming along in the world. He's now the editor of Spillway. I mean, he's just picking up all these accolades, and he's really fun to work with. He, when I did Junkie Wife, he published that, and we've been friends ever since. And he said, I want to publish this book, and this is how we'll do it, and this is our timeline, and it's going to happen either, you know, later this year or beginning of next year, but it's a done deal. Contracts are signed. Photos have been exchanged. I want to leave some kind of a visual recording of the who and the what of these poets and this place and this particular time. Going through them, I think there are 10 of them are dead now since, you know, the last 10 years.
Oh, I know.
A lot of dead poets. And, you know, I don't know. I'm hoping that this will mean something.
People need to see these photographs, because I think they're really extraordinary. But they're very different from other photographs you take. You know, you used to take huge numbers of photographs of just sort of downtown life in L.A. And you also do a lot of landscapes. And oftentimes you do certain things to the photograph to accentuate certain tones and colors in the. But these things are straight on, and every single one of them, I found myself, man, I really wanted to meet this person. I really wanted to know who they were. How many photographs are going to be in the book? Do you know?
Well, there are over 100.
Nice.
and it will be black and white. My preferred way of documenting. I think, you know, color snapshots and photographs black and white are real photographs.
Yeah.
At least to me, I'm very curious to see how it lands.
I think it's going to I think it's going to be dynamite.
Thank you.
But you're also, you know, you also are right. I mean, it's so important that these people are visually, sort of photographed and remembered. And the best way to do that is to have these photographs published. When you're photographing these people, and I want to talk to you about this, because some of them, you know, they're doing all sorts of different stuff. How do you approach your subject? How do you talk to them? How do you set up the shot?
Well, I want my photo of this person. I want them to say, this is me. This is what I look like in my head on a very good day. And that's kind of what I'm going for. I really want to show something about the poet, who they are inside. And I think you have to look at the totality. One woman, Linda Albertano, came with a trunk and a couple people to carry all her outfits and stuff.
Wow.
And that's how she showed up. And then the poet, Will Alexander, just showed up with a hat and a vest and a shirt. And I said, where's your outfits? He says, you're looking at it. And it gave me a look, an inkling into who these people are. And I just went from there.
It's interesting because so many contemporary poets, nobody knows what they look like. You may have read, and people do have blogs, and you may see them on blogs, but these photographs are totally different, very, very intimate portraits, and they're doing all sorts of extraordinary stuff. Have you ever had an exhibition of them?
Yes. I think it was 2014.
Okay.
At Beyond Baroque, which is a beautiful building and an organization that really furthers poetry in Los Angeles. It's been around for decades, and they gave me a show. I think there were 20, maybe 30 of the portraits were in the show. It was a really big deal, and we got a photo with all the poets, or 99% of them, you know, that goes with that. And like I said, at least 20, 10, 15, 20 of them are gone now.
Wow.
Just in the last few years. Yeah.
Let's hear another poem before we run out of time. How about Suicide Bridge or Blind Man's Bluff?
Okay, let's see.
I want to mention, it's always interesting because you're not afraid of going very dark.
No, I'm not. I'm going to do Blind Man's Bluff.
Okay.
There was no light coming in, he assured me. There was nothing to overcome. Think of it as an inundation, he said, like kudzu, like bankruptcy, like love. I dated a blind man in the 80s, tall, slender. He was easy on the eyes. When I asked him what it was like not to see, he told me to imagine not breathing. When I couldn't, he told me to imagine a slowly deteriorating pinhole camera with the dark encroaching. Like when you close your eyes before bed, he said, trying to be helpful. What's the last thing you see? I didn't answer. It was none of his business. I kept closing my eyes and opening them like a snapshot or a glimpse. I figured maybe I'd catch on. Maybe there were different ways of perception. To make my point, I grabbed his hand, spread the fingers, placed them on my skull. What do you see? I said. I moved his digits around my face like they were the finder on a Ouija board. Forehead, cheeks, pouty lips, chin. He patted my long, dark hair. What does brunette feel like? I asked.
Oh, wow.
He gave this some thought, like no one had asked him what he saw ever. If you're really interested, he smiled, we could duct tape your eyes shut, see how long you'd last. I could feel the panic rise up in my throat. No, I said quickly, no. It was late November, the evening sky black by 5 p.m. It's getting dark earlier each night, he said. I almost asked him how he could tell, but I knew he could feel the sun's absence. I put Amy Winehouse Back to Black on the turntable. Huh. Then I reached for his hand, pulled him to me. Want to dance? I asked. He was light on his feet, knew how to lead. I should have known.
It's an amazing poem.
Thank you.
Now, we're going to run out of time, but I want to talk to you about the poem Turning Point, which obviously prefigures your move out into the desert. Now, for as long as I've known you, I've always associated with urban L.A., and whenever you wrote that you were moving on to the desert, I was like, wow, that's pretty extreme. So how are you adjusting to it? Do you miss all the urban craziness? Like, you were taking photographs on the street all the time, and there's always something weird to look at. Now there's a lot of nature around you. Are you getting used to that?
Well, my husband and I wanted to retire. We wanted to buy a house, just have everything simple.
Yeah.
And we could not do that in Los Angeles, where tiny two-bedroom, one-bath house is going for almost $1 million in decent neighborhoods. So, we started looking in the desert. We have friends out here. We're very close to Joshua Tree.
Nice.
And we started looking, and then we found this glorious house with light and airy and seriously beautiful. And I said, yes, I'll try this. And I'm trying it. I'm getting better at it. I'm almost liking it now, but I've been very cut off and almost on purpose trying to see what that will do to my writing. And as you said, the photography, I'm really getting into clouds. They don't talk back, you know.
I know. And I'm loving your pictures of clouds and the landscapes there. Because the sky seems to be obviously it's a huge feature. There's no tall buildings around you. So it's all sky and desert. That's all it is.
That's all it is. But I thought I would see stars out here at night. And there's a layer of fog or whatever you want to call it, a mist. So I'm not. I saw more stars when I lived in L.A.
I can't. Than I do out here. I can't believe that. I'm challenging you on that. You've got to be seeing more. Maybe it's the time of the year. Maybe it's the weather.
You know, I don't know. We moved here in late June. So we've lived through summer and fall, and now the rain.
Oh, my God.
It's interesting. I'm trying to be an observer and not get sucked into the quiet.
Why? Why not just embrace the quiet?
I got no choice. We spent our money on the house. That's it for me, you know.
I envision a book of desert poetry coming up, but I'm not sure what that's going to be like at all.
Very sparse and dry.
A lot of books about rocks.
There you go.
I think that's what I'm really fascinated. I want to see the output caused by this move. By the way, that poem, Turning Point, was brutal. It almost made it seem like, man, I got to get out of there.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the downside of living in an urban environment, is that.
Well, yeah, and I just have to think of it as I'm here for the ride.
Okay.
Let's see what happens. Sometimes you have to assert yourself, and other times you just let yourself be carried along, you know, and that was this.
Well, I can hardly wait to see what this is going to produce for poetry from you. It's always fascinating. My returning guest tonight is poet and photographer Alexis Roan Fancher. And we're talking about her new book, Triggered, a Pillow Book. It's really a good read. Alex, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Likewise.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.